Now, while there will be much focus this month on the centenary of the death of Michael Collins, it's worth considering the impact of the summer of 1922 on others caught up in its intensity, including Emmett Dalton, in whose lap Collins died. A veteran of the Battle of the Somme in 1916, Dalton fought in the War of Independence, played an important role in the Civil War, went on to have a fascinating post-Civil War career. And joining me to discuss his life and legacy is historian Diarmaid Ferriter. His life reads like a kind of a boy's own adventure, really, doesn't it?
Well, it's very interesting that he eventually got involved in film production because his life was cinematic.
It really was.
And it's remarkable what he packed into the early stage of his life. You mentioned there the events of exactly 100 years ago, August 1922, and what he had experienced and what he experienced physically in West Cork in August 1922. He was only 24, so he was already a veteran of the First World War and the horrors there, and he'd witnessed the stench of death, as he put it, on the Western Front, and then involvement in the War of Independence and the Civil War. Still only 24, so it's remarkable to think, when you think of your 24-year-old self and what you were doing and what your priorities were, and then you go back to the summer of 1922 and you consider that generation of men and women who were heavily involved and what they were carrying, even at that tenor stage in their lives.
Fought at the Battle of the Somme, but not just fought in illustrious company alongside Tom Kettle.
He witnessed the death of Tom Kettle. Tom Kettle was probably the best known Irish victim of the Battle of the Somme because he'd been a Nationalist MP. And of course, he was somebody who was often cited afterwards in relation to the tragedy of war, but also in relation to the conflicting loyalties of that generation. If you consider the fluidity around it, you know, these were Irish nationalists who had no qualms about fighting with the British Army. And many of them were following the call of John Redmond, of course. And Tom Kettle was very vocal about that and very poetic, of course, about it as well. But it was something Dalton couldn't speak about. And he did record that he couldn't find the words to express his horror at what he had experienced and to watch that up close. And of course, that was only one tiny facet of what was an absolutely horrific summer of 1916.
And one tiny facet of his war, because he was then sent to Palestine and then
Palestine,
he came back to the
Western
Front.
Awarded a military cross. I mean, he was decorated. He was a very good soldier and he carried the air of a soldier. If you see photographs of him now, you can see.
Oh, a military bearing, absolutely.
Yeah, very debonair, and he had a cultured accent and he had that air of quiet authority. And he had a reputation as well for having nerves of steel. So I think what he had experienced between 1914 and 1916 as a very young man did stand to him when it came to some of the challenges that came later.
Challenges that he embraced very rapidly on his return from the war.
Well, he
joined the IRA in lickety-split time.
Yeah, he came back to a changed Ireland. It's interesting. I mean, he was from a nationalist family and his father had very strong connections to the Irish Parliamentary Party and he didn't want Emmett to join the British Army at all. But Emmett's younger brother, Charlie, was already in the IRA. So when he came back in 1919, when Emmett comes back, of course, the political climate has changed. The military situation has changed. And then his family are subjected to the kind of harassment that was common in Dublin at that time. There were raids by the auxiliaries and the Black and Tans and the Crown Forces. And himself and his father were arrested at one stage. His father entirely blameless, of course. So he was pushed in that direction. And he did have, obviously, familial contacts. But also, when you consider that generation of Christian Brothers boys, you know, that class that he would have been in North Richmond Street in the early 20th century, consider all of the characters there, people like Sean Lamass and Ernie O'Malley and the different directions that they went in, committed nationalists. And I mean, they ended up on opposite sides of the Civil War divide.
Literally,
but there were factors there that were propelling them into that space.
Yeah, I was going to say literally in the case of Sean Lamass, but we'll come to that because we're getting ahead of ourselves. He came to Michael Collins's attention, as it were, with this daring but unsuccessful raid to liberate General McGowan from Mountjoy.
Sean McGowan was in Mountjoy, and the idea was that they would hijack a British armoured car and take it into the prison and pose as British army men.
And he had the uniform in his wardrobe to do it.
And he had the bearing, as we mentioned earlier on. It was nearly successful. The problem was one of the people who was in the van had recently been released from Mountjoy and he was recognised. So there was a shootout. And there's a brilliant description of him afterwards because they managed to shoot their way out. And there's a
having gotten all the way to the warden's office, apparently?
Yeah, they got right in and then had to get right out and shoot their way out. And then this van came into sight after they'd escaped, and he was on the back smoking a cigarette, you know, like he'd just been out for some kind of a leisurely exercise.
Is it any wonder he went into movies at a scene like that?
Well, there was a lot of turmoil he had to deal with before that phase of his life. And that's the interesting thing, particularly after what he had experienced in the summer of 1922. He loved Collins, you know, and he had no hesitation in using that word. He hero worshipped him. And his 1920s are very difficult because he gets involved, obviously, in the Civil War. And this time, 100 years ago, he's at the forefront of the assault on Cork by National Army soldiers. It's an amphibious assault, and it was quite daring and novel at the time that they take Cork by the sea, National Army soldiers led by Dalton, trying to penetrate the Munster Republic and quash this anti-treaty Republican resistance.
Okay, but let's put that in a bit of proper perspective, because there was quite a bit of British assistance. I mean, it wasn't as if Dalton led that by himself, was it?
No, and he had no qualms about that. There was discreet assistance. And he later would have defended the recruiting of former British Army troops into the National Army as well, because he thought they were very effective and very disciplined soldiers, even though some of his contemporaries, of course, were aghast at that. But their experience was needed at that time. And the idea was to try, as he put it, to squeeze the Republican fighters in every direction. And, you know, the Cork operation was not without its difficulties. It was simplified subsequently. But some of his correspondence back to Dublin is very frantic and despairing about a lack of coordination and a lack of discipline. And there are problems with the National Army throughout the period. But it gets particularly bad after the death of Collins, obviously.
We're jumping all over the place and getting kind of ahead of ourselves here. Let's just go back and continue with the sort of the chronological approach here, because he went with Collins to London, but not as a plenipotentiary or even as a part of the treaty team, was he?
He's fulfilling different roles. In a way, he's a bodyguard, but he is also formally put on one of these subcommittees to do with military matters, that he would advise the delegation on certain military matters that he had experience in. But one of the jobs he gets involved in is to purchase the plane that is put on standby to take Collins out of London in the event that it is necessary. And it was bought for $2,500.
When you say necessary, in the event that the treaty negotiations collapsed and Collins was trapped behind
enemy
lines.
Absolutely. Get him out as quickly as they could from Croydon. Now, that didn't happen in the event, but he's involved in all of those kind
and
of
that,
things.
And that's the founding plane, I suppose,
well,
of the Air Corps.
Yeah, some would consider that the beginning of the Air Corps story, which it is in many ways. But that was also a period during which he is asked, particularly after the signing of the treaty, which he supported, that he is asked to liaise with Neville Macready, who's the commander of the British forces in Ireland, to deal with the transition period, because originally he was working with Neville Macready with regard to the truce. So he's steeped in all of that, and he's very close to Collins, and Collins trusts him.
So next up then, obviously, is the shelling of the forecourts, something that he again did with the discreet assistance of the British.
Yeah, but he is very aggressive in his insistence that they have to be routed, that they have to be moved out. So he is leading the charge in many ways when it comes to the growing impatience with the occupation of the forecourts. And again, you know, you have that assistance there as well. And that physical assistance was needed at that time. And of course, Winston Churchill, as Secretary of State for the colonies, was being very gung-ho about providing that. But the question then is what comes afterwards? You know, and in military terms, the Civil War as a contest is over very quickly. You know, it really is over by this time 100 years ago. The challenge then is to try and quash the Republican resistance in Munster in particular, because they retreat, of course, to a guerrilla type of campaign. And that can be very frustrating. And of course, it's overshadowed. Everything is overshadowed then by the death of Collins. But he eventually resigns his National Army Commission in December 1922.
Again, let's go back. Let's not skip over the fact that he was at Bail na Blaw and he advised Collins against stopping and fighting.
But it was a stupid thing to do, wasn't it? A military blunder, a stupid military blunder. Drink had been taken. Judgment, I think, was clouded.
And highlights the fact that, I mean, Collins, for all of his genius, was not a military mind.
Not at all.
In the same way that Dalton was.
He'd only been in uniform a couple of weeks. You know, Collins was at his most effective behind a desk. You know, he was a brilliant administrator and he was a very good coordinator and he had more talents than many of his contemporaries, but he was not a fighting soldier. And privately, some of his contemporaries were very scathing about the idea or the image of Collins as the fighting man. And that photograph, of course, dominates of Collins in the uniform, but it's not reflective of the reality of his career up to then. So it was a stupid military blunder. Of course, they should have kept on going. But of course, Dalton has to experience those final moments and he's trying to dress the wound on his head and he dies in his arms. So again, great trauma wrapped up in that. But the war goes on. And he's there in Cork in the aftermath of that, trying to deal with problems of indiscipline. He's got correspondence with Richard Mulcahy, who takes over from Collins as Commander-in-Chief of the National Army. And he's despairing and also ruthless at the same time. But he does come to a point by the end of 1922 where he realises, we're not in control here. We're not in control of our troops. There are breakdowns of discipline. Where does he end up? He ends up as clerk of the Shannon. They give him that job for $4,000 a year to try and get him out of that Cork hothouse.
Okay. And he resigns his commission, you're saying, in disgust at what the National Army has become.
Exactly. And again, there's a degree of ambiguity about that. But you can see that in the correspondence, that he is getting increasingly concerned about the freelance operations, ruthless freelance operations that are going on.
Did you ever see the Cathal O'Shannon documentary that he made and was broadcast, I think, around about, maybe even on the day that he died?
He died on his 80th birthday. And shortly before that, you can understand, you know, there was much interest in the idea of revisiting the Beilnab Law scene. And he went down and agreed to be involved in that documentary.
But didn't agree to meet the people who had been behind the attack.
Well, he was asked, would he meet some of the surviving members of the column that had been involved in the ambush? And his response was, if their only claim to fame is that they shot at me from behind a wall, I don't want to meet the bastards. Fair enough.
Again, we've skipped ahead here because after his stint in the Shannon, 3 years as a clerk, which really, I mean, for a man when you consider who had signed up to the British Army at the age of 15, had been at the Somme, had been in Palestine, been back at the Western Front again.
He described it as a very dull place, not surprisingly.
That he went off and he was quite restless for a number of years.
He is. I mean, I've really discovered this over the course of the last couple of years in researching the pension applications of that generation. There's a real difficulty of settling, you know, of establishing roots. They're very restless. There are multiple changes of address. He hits the bottle as well. He's suffering from shell shock and post-traumatic stress disorder. His marriage is in trouble.
But his brother was in real trouble.
His brother was in real trouble as well and had a series of breakdowns and ended up in Grange Gorman at one stage. So there are real difficulties to be endured there. And his wife threatens to leave him at one stage unless he cleans up his act. He actually arrives drunk in 1932 into the postmaster's office demanding access to pensions correspondence from the Department of Defence, and you know he was drinking his way around pubs of Dublin with his revolver. So he is out of control, but, and this is interesting again, he manages to turn his life around and he has that inner core discipline. He gives up drink completely. He tries to get jobs as a travelling salesman. He actually gets heavily involved in gambling as well, as a kind of a professional gambler during the Second World War. He has contacts with people in the film industry, including in Paramount Films in London, and he works for them for a period. So he sells encyclopedias. You know, he tries his hand at a variety of different things. And it was a growing family. Okay. There were eventually five kids, and his daughter, Audrey, actually became a very well-known actress.
Travelling salesman, encyclopedia salesman, whatever, before arriving upon, almost stumbling upon the idea of Ardmore Studios.
Yeah, Ardmore eventually 1958 gets the go-ahead. And of course, there was a big job of persuasion there in relation to the feasibility of an Irish film industry. But he felt that there could be an appetite, particularly in America, for Irish films and for those kind of themes.
But he was
explored.
Also particularly successful at bringing productions that were shot in Ireland but not located here, like The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, which was shot in the Liberties in
and
Dublin.
And James Cagney was seen in Dublin in relation to Shaking the Hand of the Devil, I think it was called. Another film was This Other Eden. Now, it's in trouble by 1963.
The Lion in Winter as well. I mean,
It doesn't last. It's in trouble by 1963. It's very difficult to sustain it. And of course, you might have a successful film, but then you can have a series of unsuccessful films as well. So it was difficult to sustain that. But it would be regarded as the beginnings of the domestic Irish film industry. And he does play a role in that, an important one.
Put it in perspective. I mean, what an amazing life. Where do you put him? Yet he's not one of the people that we automatically think of as one of the great historical figures of this period.
Yeah, well, I mean, they've been overshadowed, I suppose, by the relentless focus on the likes of Collins and indeed De Valera. I've often referred to the lottery of 1922, you know, when you consider Collins dying so young. And there you have Dalton living until his 80th birthday. You know, not without difficulties. And obviously he experienced a lot of trial and tribulation. They were able to inflict considerable pain, but they endured considerable pain as well. So it is about trying to understand how they sought to make sense of what they had been through. and how they, in many respects, after the Civil War, sought to patch together a viable existence for themselves and provide for their families. And again, that's quite a lottery, and it can depend too on the kind of context that you've established and your social and economic background.
Yeah, I suppose it is as informative to remember those people who turned their back on politics, who turned their back on any kind of a public life after all those experiences and said, no, I'm sorry, I just need to go and be a private citizen.
And that is why so much was internalised. And you can appreciate that. Why would they want to revisit the horrors, as they saw it, of 1922 and 1923 in particular? Many of them, of course, did not want to pass on their own preferences and prejudices to the next generation, which was quite a noble thing.
Not to mention the horrors of 1916. Just before we go, let's take a listen to him in his own words describing the Battle of the Somme.
It would be very hard to describe the Somme. I don't know that there's ever been a battle like it. I mean, you had two armies in static positions. The movement of either of them would be about 200 yards, the difference between the two basic front lines. And the Somme, which had been built and rebuilt as a battleground by the British, initially to relieve pressure on Verdun, but it became a cesspool.
That's him in his late 70s, very sharp and very on the money.
You never forget that experience, slaughter on an industrial scale. And it's no surprise in his late 70s that he was still struggling to find the words to describe the horrors.
Emmett Dalton, a life remembered there by Dermot Ferriter. Dermot, thank you very much.